that is, the knowledge is that power God has given us to serve Him better. It's certainly clear that the poet found in the Nicaeus confirmation of a number of his own convictions expressed in other works. First, the notion that free will is an attribute of reason, along with the conclusion that men are vicious through misuse rather than defective reason. Second, the conclusion that men's actions are mixed with free will and providence, that there is both God's universal and particular providence over men. And third, a commonplace that really shows that many intellectuals of his time, and most almost all intellectuals, I think, of his time, such as George Herbert, for example, and Sir Thomas Brown, the false belief in man and multiplicity, occupying the central place in God's creation. And we have here a brief quotation from this particular section. "Behold that he bindeth, that is man, bindeth together in himself things mortal and immortal, and knitteth up in one things reasonable and unreasonable. In his own nature he beareth the image of all creatures, of whom God hath that faith to make so much regard, that all created things, both present and to come, work for him to it." Thus Ritter's translation of Dona Cora Hominum illustrates his growing humanistic point of view. Finding much in the treatise he could agree with, he was now able to implement a useful resolve to employ what he calls philosophy, counsel, and reason to effect inner reform. The next verse is The Modern Statesman, dated 1653. To place Ritter's two later humanistic works within the context of his literary career and historical background, demands some mention of the press activities between the outbreak of the Civil War and the Restoration. Between 1640 and 1660, require mention to show how he consistently defended the parliamentary letters of Cromwellian regime. Letters of advice, for example, provide conscientious voters a plan for selling Great Britain parliamentary seats if men rally to a new government. The same year, speech without door offers a money raising plan to enable the parliament to carry on its war against the cavalry. Another, the British appeal, defends a new republic in the Cromwell. After 1649, Ritter saw the abolishing of the House of Lords, Cromwell's victories in Ireland, the abrogation of the rent, the unhappy failure of the Bourbon Parliament dominated by the independents, and finally Cromwell named protector by the instrument of government in 1653. With the permanent Council of State and the Parliament elected at 3-year intervals, along with toleration for those not openly professing popery or policy, the court apparently had high hopes for a republic of virtue. The Modern Statesman, issued that same year, presents his views on how such an ideal state can be created. If only his countrymen, as new patrons of liberty, apply lessons from Roman history and philosophy to their reform of government. This little known treatise reveals Ritter's humanism in its most complete and impressive statement. We call for a little more detailed comment. It seems more than probable that Ritter's knowledge of Minucius prompted him to find wisdom of the ancient culture in solving political problems of the 1650s. Certainly, Minucius convinced him that natural philosophy and Christian apologetics could teach man to lead a better life by better knowing himself. From further study of Roman history in particular, as he presents it in his book, Ritter contends that if enlightened and selfish conduct in war and social reconstruction can generate a better society, it's only because better men have become more conscientious citizens. Ritter derived, I think, more than motivation from the nature of man. Ritter implies an objective point of view and a thorough presentation of ideas by definition and illustration so completely in The Modern Statesman that some critics have even questioned his authorship, though I think on very generous grounds. Declaring that the history of all great nations like that of Rome shows their flourishing in peace after war, the poet considers the birth of the English Commonwealth an auspicious event. Along with gaining her freedom, she can now regain her reputation. No longer subject to a tyrannical monarch, Englishmen at last can learn to shoulder responsibilities entailed by their new freedom. They must not grumble about higher taxes to cause a foreign and domestic dissension. Gregory further declares that the Cromwellian settlement has done more for the people's welfare in Syria than the Manichee had done in 400 years previously. One contends that true patriots could gladly give up Moorish deity for political and religious liberty. The magical works and political history dealing with the evolution of the Roman Republic really discovered many exemplary precedents who seriously thought worthy of emulation. It's his application of these that again points up the humanistic base. He eulogizes the wisdom of ancient history for teaching men proper conduct. They should therefore, he says, dust themselves in the grass of other men's actions, since in the large volume of history they will find many invaluable parallels. By the instruction of the fledgling English Republic, he then cites the Romans in 1570 inferior creatures back to the superior. He cites their elaborate propitiations of their gods at the start of close in any great public business, as for example their public thanksgivings after Hannibal's first retreat to Italy. He argues further that the Romans did not think valor inconsistent with piety, and clearly implies that his countrymen should follow their example. Over half of the 26 chapters of the modern statesman serve as a defense of marriage. In these sections, Ritter stresses repeatedly the dependence of exemplary individual and group conduct on learning. Remaining us of the Nunciate, he presents first Greek and Roman lessons of moral virtue, which is not a way to moral conduct. In a crowd, Robert willing the will and appetite of man, conforming and composing his manners to the health and ornament of humane society. Its efficient cause, he says, is custom, its end a common good. Ritter follows Cicero in examining moral virtue further, discovers in it four manifestations in man's conduct: prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. With ample illustration and anecdote, he discusses in turn the relation of these four components to each other. Thus, prudence, the exact knowledge of what is good and evil, is dependent on a man's intelligence, learning, and social experience. Besides knowledge gained from history and philosophy, one study of philology, geometry, and geography, he says, will also help to make men prudent. The Romans in 50 said only experienced men of a certain age hold high office is another precedent to perpetuate people's desire. One final reference to this appealing work could be made. Ritter's most fervid defense of learning appears in his discussion of the relation of learning to religion in chapters 13 through 16. Instead of its undermining religion, learning, in his view, strongly serves as handmaid to religion because our knowledge, that is our reading and our critical faculty, precedes our inclination to believe. In a sanctified heart, he says, learning becomes a sanctified instrument to achieve God's grace. Even though learning, the outward means without faith, the inward means is truly vain, and even though many learned men are taught and affected, Ritter rightly argues that the bitter, unreasonable abuse of learning is no argument against its properness, and the mischief of ignorance is really, he says, the devil's proper work. Comparing with Plutarch, the poet insists that the supreme value of learning, however, is its freeing our minds from superstition. It's typical of Ritter to insist further that learning promotes toleration and supplying Protestants with ammunition against Catholicism. Now, the last work is Fides Anglicanum, 1660. And in that case, parenthetically, this is a kind of mismatch of Godwell verse and prose. Quite typical of the writer in that it includes prophecy along with some notion of humanism. By contrast to the modern statesman, Fides Anglicanum is a personal statement of advice and complaint to the restored monarchy under Charles II. It's mainly a patriot plea for repayment for land confiscated from him by the Restoration government. The first two sections describe rivers and other purchasers' sufferings when their properties were being retained. Only section 3, the poet remonstrance is relevant to this discussion. Here he cites four precedents, mainly from Roman history, with one from the Bible, justify this common grievance against the government. Again, he draws quotations and paraphrases like this in Roman thought, chiefly from the epistles of Marcus Aurelius, to learn historical truth and to universalize his conviction that no government can long live ignoring its citizens' welfare. Two examples will suffice to show how Ritter in this instance utilizes humanistic studies to support his own convictions. In confirming that any nation's neglect of justice is perilous, he illustrates in the epistles the destruction of the city of Palermo in 720 BC. It's perilous. It's a clear warning to the restoration government at this time of crisis. Reduce Aliena, who built it, Cecilia in Pace Cathedral. In another anecdote, one that clearly echoes Ritter's personal grievances to Parliament, as expressed in the petitioner narrative of George Ritter, 1659, he declares that oppressed subjects of even the lowest station enjoy a just freedom in seriously venting their grievances to the greatest potentates of the world. Drawn again from Aurelius, he recounts the stories of two courageous spokesmen who are later honored after firstly waiting the Roman Senate for its disregard of justice. Undoubtedly, the monetary narrative of the German Simon Milano, who relates the Roman Senate, who wasted the better part of his life in vain hopes and tedious prosecution, fits Ritter's own case perfectly. This survey of Ritter's verse and prose showing his response to late Renaissance humanism also suggests strongly that his whole career might be studied from a new perspective. Between Masson's description of Ritter in 1859 as a brave, bull-necked Englishman slightly crazed in the organs of combativeness and self-esteem, to Jordan's estimate in 1936 as a poet who is one of the most completely misunderstood men of the 17th century, there's certainly a tenable middle ground. This, I think, we can largely defend on the basis of Ritter's humanism and his lifelong devotion to public service. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Hensley. Dr. Richard Hacker of the University of Missouri has often shared with this conference some of the results of his research into the Anderson State, and he is going to do so again this morning with a paper on prototypes for the Renaissance stage in England. some chief aspects of this show as affecting production. The show is the show itself, which I'm going to show a way of platform. There's the top door, there's the function gear for the sound effect. I prefer to call a discovery space of some sort. Some people call the inner show, I don't like the term. And then there is an upper place, a raised station of some sort, what I call a raised column area, an upward time, but much better than the time upper show, which again I think is misleading, brings in modern attention. And fifth, a music room. So let's talk about the shaft or the stone at all. They are relatively simple, I think. There was one large top door, I think, in the middle of the stage in most of the courthouses. And most of the public courthouses anyway, and one or two of the private courthouses had the means of lowering Jupiter or Venus or an angel of the Lord or Hosea the prophet from above a vertical descent to the stage. The only question now is in the recorder, how far up in the time is my pleasure? Well, 4 feet. I'm going to speak in what I call the discovery space and the raised column area and the music room. And this conference has been most hospitable to my presentation of a number of theories about the three parts of the Elizabethan story. I heard it called a column bar if you recite 15 or more minutes. But I shall never again offer a paper on which he says to his conscience. I think that I'd like to show the first picture now. I want to begin with the Crown Dome, which is always referenced as well. This is a much misunderstood drawing, of course, and we can't look at it and study it enough. If we could only understand this, I think we would have the secret. If we can have it right away around, it would be easy to look away. I'm sorry, I can't really describe it in the world. Anyway. This is a magnificent piece of iron. Here is the inside of the Lincoln Tower. So it's 4 years before it broke. Now, this is what we need, what we know. And for 75 years or so, we've been keeping the evidence and rejecting it, driving it. I think that it is an enormous study. When we see it, we can show it first of all, where it's postponed as a citizen in the 19th. And it's an enormous order. There are also several numerals, the house and the club, they are higher than that, as the contract says, what the document. Two large doors, which presumably, presumably open house, for us because of the Hebrews, and then a little room above. No one is saying no upper story at all. Now, my three interesting stories are these. The first one is that the new ground of practices of the Lord's name, the Lord's intention to the name, but maybe that those five posts which is clear above the stage correspond to partitions, and that we have in fact six lamps. And there are references to the Bible, or not to the Lord's room, and the rest of the Lord's room to the floor, and so we don't know who that was. Now, one of these boxes can very easily be used by Jesus, in heaven by when we're on the floor of the Lord. Or by the people who are in that same chapter, with bones up in the assembly in the stage today. Is there any support for all right, I think so much I have a little bit, but I'm not sure I'm here, I have not any of the answer. This is a difficult concept to accept, the mixture of audience and answer, because we don't do it, we've seen it in that quarter, but all of the evidence from many of the directions seems to require us to propose that an application of emails was not made by them then. So, here is a place above where you can put people. Below, if you open one of those doors, you can have a discovery. Except that the process in his study, behind one of those doors, and you don't. Without a chance of hand. But if you're still at hand and put it in the Thank you.